Shrek is a computer-generated animation movie, actually several of them at this point, that celebrates the worth of marginalized people in our society. In the film, an ogre named Shrek and a talking donkey attempt to rescue a princess from a dragon-guarded castle. And on the way to gain freedom for Princess Fiona, Shrek and Donkey come to a rickety wooden bridge that spans a moat filled with fiery lava. There's no way to reach the castle and Princess Fiona except across this bridge covering the fiery lava. The ogre is ready to go, but the donkey is terrified and refuses to go across the bridge until Shrek kind of encourages him, "Well, I'll be with you all the way across." And so they start across the bridge. When they reach the midway point, a rotten plank in the bridge comes loose and falls down into the burning lava, the flames below, and Donkey loses his concentration, and he looks down and he screams, "I can't do this. Just let me off right now." Well, even though Shrek insists they can do it, the donkey turns around to go back, but Shrek is in his way. And Shrek, in pretending to be angry, begins to swing the suspension bridge back and forth and back and forth. And Donkey shuffles backwards now across the bridge, trying to get away from Shrek and his swinging of the bridge. Before he knows it, the outraged donkey has made his way all the way across the bridge backwards to the castle, and Shrek has delivered his friend safely to the other side. Fear. We think of fear as a bad thing, but fear, the right kind of fear, can be a very good thing when used to accomplish the right ends. Sometimes God has to swing the bridge so that we are terrified until we get to where He wants us to be. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, we learn that God's heavy hand teaches us to fear Him. One writer says that God has an unmerciful mercy. I like that expression. God has an unmerciful mercy. God is merciful. God is love. God is gracious. God is good. We love those themes. We love to talk about those themes. We sing about those things, those themes, as we have sung this morning. God is merciful. But sometimes the merciful God can do unmerciful things to us in His mercy to cause us to fear Him. And in 1 Samuel chapters 5, 6, and 7, we are looking at a theme, and the theme is the heavy hand of God. God is placing His heavy hand. First, He places it on the Israelites. Then He places His heavy hand upon the Philistines. Then He places His heavy hand back on the Philistines. Now, how many of you like the heavy hand of God? It's not a pleasant theme. But why does God do this? To produce fear, the right kind of fear. God's heavy hand teaches us to fear Him. Principle number one this morning, God's glory humiliates His enemies. Verses 1 through 5. Now the ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines 7 months, And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place." And they said, "If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but you shall surely return to him a guilt offering. Then you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you." Then they said, "What shall be the guilt offering which we shall return to him?" And they said, "Five golden tumors and five golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you shall make likenesses of your tumors and likenesses of your mice that ravage the land. And you shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will ease his hand from you, your gods, and your land." Now back in chapter 5 and verse 6, we read that the hand of the Lord was heavy. Again in verse 11, we read that the hand of God was very heavy. Now in verse 5 of chapter 6, we read that the Philistines will give glory to the God of Israel. And I have noted before that there is a play on words here in the Hebrew language. We're going to see it again a little bit later in this passage, and I'll talk about it there as well. But there's a play on words, because the same Hebrew root that means heavy also means glory. It's the same Hebrew root word. It's kavod. So God's glory is his heaviness, and God's heaviness is his glory. Heavy and glory, there's that play on words here. So the heavy hand of God in judgment was driving the Philistines to reluctantly give him glory out of fear. God's glory then humiliates his enemies so that they give him glory even when they don't want to give him glory. The ark had been in the land of the Philistines for 7 months at this point. Now back in chapter 4 and verse 22, we read about the daughter-in-law of Eli. When the ark was taken, verse 22, she said, "The glory has departed from Israel." That's the word ikavod. The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken. Well, if the glory of the Lord has left Israel, where did it go? Where did the glory of God go? It now resides among the Philistines. And if the glory of the God of Israel now resides among the Philistines, then the heavy hand of the Lord also resides where? Among the Philistines. So the glory of the Lord and his heavy hand go together throughout this sequence of events. Now the Israelites called it the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Contract, the Ark of the Covenant that God has with his people. It was called that because God made a covenant with the people of Israel. He made a covenant with them that he would be gracious, he would take care of them, he would protect them, he would bless them, and they made an agreement to obey him and follow him and honor him. So God's covenant was gracious, but it also required obedience. God promised to protect his people, and they promised to obey and honor him. That was the covenant relationship. And the ark was the symbol of that covenant contractual relationship. The covenant has been broken by the people of Israel, and the glory was gone, but it's not gone permanently. God would prove his glory by using his heavy hand to enforce his glory. I mean, if man won't give God glory because of his grace, man will give God glory because of his judgment. That's the way God works. The ark had traveled to three cities in the land of Philistia, ending up at Ekron. In each place, God smote the people we looked at last Sunday with tumors. And as we pointed out last week, the word most often referred to hemorrhoids. But many today think that this was more like the bubonic plague because there was death associated with it and because of the mice that we find out here. However, of course, the mice, we're told, were ravaging the land. So the Philistines not only had these tumors, these very painful sores, but they also had mice going throughout their granaries, their grain fields. Their land was being ravaged, and people were dying. And we talked about the deadly confusion that went through the land as a result of God's judgment. So, the five lords of the Philistines, remember, the Philistines were built on, they were five city-states with five kings or lords, one of each city-state, and they were sort of a coalition together. The five lords of the city-states get together and say, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this? And they call the priests, and the priests advise that the ark has to go back to its place. And not only that, they're to offer a guilt offering. And the expression is the guilt offering of Israel, interestingly enough. They're to offer a guilt offering, a payment. What are they doing? They're sort of paying off God, aren't they? They're paying off the God of Israel for a wrong they've done to this God of Israel. Let's pay this God off with an offering, give him back his ark, because we're rather in pain. Let's give him glory so he will take his heavy hand from our gods and our land and us. It's a bribe to God. They want to pay God off and get him out of their lives. Now, that's the way people often think, isn't it? Especially who do not know God. People think that they need to pay God off or bribe God so they can get out from under whatever it is that is making them uncomfortable, that is painful, that is difficult. So we'll pay God off and then he'll leave us alone and we'll be okay and we'll be able to go back to our lives and what we want to do. We'll be able to get out of the mess we're in at the moment. So let's just pay God off. But as one writer put it, how do you repay a debt you cannot assess to a God you do not know? How do you pay a debt you can't figure out? They don't even know what the debt is to a God you don't even know. The solution they come up with, well, quite frankly, makes them the laughing stock of Israel. God does some weird things in this passage, and they did some weird things. And so they decide, well, we'll make five models of these tumors, one for each lord. Well, that's great. And five model mice, one for each city. I think I'll stop here lest the sermon degenerate into some bathroom humor. But the lords of Philistia are being compared to tumors and mice. That's their payment. They're being absolutely humiliated by their own people in order to get rid of the God of Israel. It's an incredible, humiliating, shameful experience for these very proud kings. So proud that they had defeated Israel just 7 months earlier. I mean, the late night talk shows would have had great material for their jokes at the expense of the lords of the Philistines. God has some unique ways of making his point. And he still has unique ways of making his point. He can humiliate, he can shame people who stand against him. Shame is a powerful weapon. And God will sometimes use shame. We even use shame, or we try to, in our society. In Alabama, a judge ordered two shoplifters to stand at a Walmart entrance for 8 hours, wearing signs that read, "I am a thief, I stole from Walmart." "Maybe they'll think twice about doing it," said the store manager, Neil Hawkins. Well, he might be right. Perhaps we ought to use shame more often in our justice system. But quite frankly, the loss of shame in our society is leading to a total breakdown of morality. Nobody seems to feel ashamed anymore of anything. Instead, people seem proud of whatever behaviors they carry out, as if those behaviors are sort of a badge of honor. "That's me. This is the way I am. Accept me." There's no shame. In fact, our society teaches us that shame is a bad thing, and we're not supposed to make anybody feel ashamed anymore. That's not true. Shame is a powerful tool to drive us to righteousness, right behavior, and to God. Shame is not necessarily bad. Shame can be a good thing when we are ashamed about bad behavior and bad choices. So we need to recapture a sense of shame, especially when we are standing before a holy God. God shames people who refuse to be ashamed at what they have done. Second principle this morning: God's power is tested by fools. Verse 6. "Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? When he had severely dealt with them, did they not allow the people to go, and they departed? Now therefore take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never been a yoke, and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. And take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart, and put the articles of gold which you returned to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side. Then send it away that it may go. And watch if it goes up by the way of its own territory to Beit Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it was not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by chance." It was a coincidence. "Then the men did so and took two milk cows and hitched them to the cart, shut up their calves at home. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the likenesses of their tumors. And the cows took the straight way in the direction of Beit Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beit Shemesh." In 2006, St. Petersburg Times reported the death of a Ukrainian man. The man was mauled by a lioness at the Kiev Zoo. He encountered the animal in that zoo on purpose. A zoo official said the man lowered himself by a rope into a concrete enclosure holding the four lions, shouting, "God will save me if he exists." He took off his shoes and began walking toward the lions. One lioness came to meet him. She knocked him down, quickly severed his carotid artery. Zoo officials stated that the incident, which occurred in front of a large crowd of people who were there at the zoo, was the first of its kind. What a fool. Well, the Philistine lords are fools too. And so is everyone who tests God. It's the height of foolishness. These leaders were proud men, and they were too proud to just leave it at this. They were being humiliated. They knew that. But apparently, there was a debate, an argument going on, and they looked for a way to save face. Don't we do that so often? And they decided to test God. And in the end, God makes it even more certain that he's the one doing all of these things to him. Some of them apparently argued, well, it's all just coincidence, you know. All of these circumstances, they're just sort of by chance these things are happening. And so they devise a test that is really rigged in their favor, of course. And the priests have to argue with them in verse 6. And they argue that the lords must not harden their hearts like the Egyptians, because look how the Egyptians in the end and Pharaoh had to give in to the Lord and send the Israelites away. So don't harden your hearts. Now, there's another play on the same Hebrew word here. Because guess what? The word kavod, which can be translated, we've already learned, heavy, or glory, can also be translated harden. It's the same word. Same root Hebrew word. Heavy, glory, and harden. So there's a play on words here, and the etymology is kind of interesting, I think. Understand that in the ancient world, scales were used to determine the value of anything. They didn't really have a monetary system originally, so scales were used. And the heavier the item on one side of the scale, the more valuable that item. So heaviness came to be associated with value or glory or honor. Now, how do we get to harden? Well, if you and God were on a set of scales, and you determined that you were heavier, more valuable than God, then you are hardening your heart against God. You are considering yourself more valuable than God on the scales of human values. So to harden one's heart was to say, I am more valuable than you, God. I deserve more honor than you, God. So when Pharaoh, or in this case, the lords of the Philistines, hardened their hearts, they are standing against God and saying in pride, I am more valuable than you. So a heavy heart is a heart that seeks its own glory, its own pride, its own solutions. A heavy heart is hardened against the heavy hand of God and refuses to give God glory. So the priest suggests a compromise test. They will take two cows that still have nursing calves, and they have never pulled a cart before, so they've never been trained to pull a cart. These two cows with calves will be separated from their calves. The calves will be put back in the barn. They will be hitched up to a cart, and they will have no driver. The cows will be set on a road that leads to Beit Shemesh. And if the cows simply pull this cart down that road all the way to the Israelite city of Beit Shemesh, then we'll know that God's in this. But if the cows turn around and go back to their calves, as most cows would, or wander aimlessly without a driver in the fields, then we'll say, it's just coincidence. It's just a coincidence. So they've rigged the test in their favor so that they don't have to give God glory. Lots of people play the same game today. People get in trouble. They decide to pay God off to get him out of their lives or to get out of the mess that they're in or to let them off the hook. They're willing to jump through some hoops, but at the same time, make deals with God. People set up little tests. And you know, when we set up tests with God, we always rig them in our favor. Okay, God, we'll do it this way. We'll do all of these things, and if they all happen over the next 3 weeks, everything lines up, oh, you must be in this. But if not, well, it's just a bunch of coincidence and I'm okay. When God doesn't do what we artificially set up, then what do we do? I mean, we don't want to feel better about this as a God thing when he's judging us. It's all, you know, phew, I'm off the hook. Well, then God doesn't do it our way, just to show us who's really in charge, who's really powerful. Philistine city of Ekron was located on the coastal plain west of the Sorek Valley. Beth Shemesh, which by the way means house of the sun, probably a Canaanite name, probably originally a city that worshipped the sun god, taken over by the Israelites. Beth Shemesh was the Israelite city closest to the city of Ekron as you move east through the Sorek Valley. And here you can see that the city of Beth Shemesh was located in the middle of this wide and fertile farming valley, and the cows were set on the western end of the valley and headed east up the valley. To the surprise of the Philistine lords, they took off down the valley, lowing as they went. Now, there wasn't a nice, neat highway there, of course, but there probably was some sort of a path along with the fields and everything. The cows went lowing as they went, reluctantly, obviously, not happily, for their calves were back there. But they head straight, the Hebrew text says, all the way down that valley, not turning one way or the other, as if driven by an unseen hand. Guess what? Guess what, lords of Philistia? They are being driven by an unseen hand. And the lords follow along, watching this amazing event. I wonder what they thought. I wonder what they thought as they watched these untrained milk cows head down with a driverless cart straight to the Israelite city. They had devised a test of God that they thought was foolproof. Instead, God made them out to be fools. Third principle, God's victories are verified by witnesses. Verse 13. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they raised their eyes. They saw the ark, and they were glad to see it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite and stood there. Just stops. Of course. Driverless, but right to this spot, where there was a large stone, and they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on the large stone. The men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices that day to the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron that day. And these are the golden tumors which the Got that on the brain already. which the Philistines returned for a gift. I got to get out of this section of scripture. It's just returned for a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. Those are the five city-states. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both of fortified cities and of country villages, the large stone on which they set the ark of the Lord is a witness, a testimony to this day in the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite. So, it was May or June, because that was the wheat harvest time in the land of Israel. The Israelites were out in their fields harvesting wheat when these two cows, lowing like crazy, come straight down the valley with the Ark of the Covenant. It must have been a rather strange sight. No driver, two milk cows instead of oxen, pulling a cart in distress. People look a little closer. There's the Ark. Amazing. What do we do with this one? This is amazing. They're glad. They're excited. Now, we know nothing about Joshua other than he's named here, his field. It's a common Israelite name, of course. But in his field was a large stone, and there they stop. And that becomes the focal point for the sacrifice. Beth Shemesh was one of the Levitical cities. So it's not surprising that there are Levites there, because God had set up certain cities as Levitical cities. That's where the Levites were to live. And so there are Levites there who can take charge. They know what to do with the ark. The two milk cows are prepared for sacrifice. They are sacrificed. The cart is broken up and burned up as a part of that sacrifice after they remove the golden tumors and the mice and, of course, the ark itself. So God has set this whole matter up to be a marvelous testimony of his power. He has done it in a way that would be memorable, that they would tell this story again and again and again and laugh probably, at least at this juncture in the story, because, wow, God is really amazing. A marvelous testimony. And God does that. When God wins big victories like these, he makes sure that there are plenty of witnesses to verify what he has done. Hebrews 4 tells us that Hebrews 2 tells us that God did that in the first century with the founding of the church and the miracles that attested or verified God's power. And God does it here to verify his power. He wants the Israelites and the Philistines both to remember his power as they retell this story. Notice the witnesses that God sets up for this event. There are three categories of witnesses in this section. First, we have the Israelite farmers. They are amazed by this whole thing. They are witnesses that, yes, the milk cows brought this right down to us. And there's the Ark of the Covenant. We saw all that took place. Wow. Secondly, there's the five lords of the Philistines. They followed all the way to the point where they could, probably one of the hillsides around this valley, where they could look down into the valley from a safe distance and make sure and see exactly what happens. So they are the second category of witnesses. This Hebrew God is an interesting God. Did they hurry home to make sure that the plague had been lifted from their cities? Probably. We're told they went right back. Did they come up with another explanation? We don't know. Now, the third witness, the final witness, was the rock itself. How many times does God do that in the Old Testament? He sets up some mountain, some rock, some physical place as a witness, as a testimony. So every time the Israelites walk by this rock for years to come in that valley, they're going to say, yeah, that was the place right there where we saw the ark, where God did something amazing and where we worshiped him and sacrificed to him. Yeah, that's the place. The rock itself becomes the final testimony. Three witnesses to the nature of God, and all testify in different ways to God's glory. He is a God to be feared, even as we love him. And the balance is very important. You know, it is so easy today to look upon God as in a chummy way, in a best friend way. He's my best buddy. He's the one who fixes everything for me. He's my big daddy. And we talk about God, we even sing about God in a real chummy way today, in our worship and in our praise. Well, God is love, yes, and He is grace, and He does care for us. But He is also a God to be feared. He is a holy God. He is a separate God. And we have to maintain that balance. Unfortunately, the Israelites had to learn that lesson the hard way, because God has one more lesson to teach in this section. Fourth, God's holiness shocks the presumptuous. Verse 19. And He, God, struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down of all the people 50,070 men. And the people mourned because the Lord had struck down the people with a great slaughter. Now these are His own, these are the Israelites, remember. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall He go up from us?" Let's get rid of Him. So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you." Apparently they didn't bother to tell them that a bunch of them had just died. "It's yours. Help yourself. Come take it." Now, what happens in these verses is, again, very strange. And I mean, the whole section is almost weird, the way God is working. And yet true. God kills many Israelites for taking Him too casually, for not treating the ark with the proper respect. Exactly what they did, we're not entirely sure. The Hebrew's a little bit hard to translate here. The Jewish historian Josephus says that they touched the ark. And of course, only the Levites were allowed to carry the ark, and they weren't allowed to touch it. They were supposed to carry it by the poles. The text says that they looked on the ark, or it can be translated as the New American Standard does, that they looked into the ark. And I really think that that's probably the most plausible solution, that some of the men there looked into the ark, which God had forbidden for people to do. What was inside the ark? Well, curiosity overwhelmed some of them. I think they opened the top, they looked inside. There were three items that we are told in Scripture were to be placed in the ark: the Ten Commandments, or the testimonies in stone, the rod of Aaron, and a bowl of manna were the three items to be placed in the ark. Looking inside was sin, and God judges this sin severely. "For you are not to take me casually. You are not to be careless around me," God is saying. "And this is the symbol of my covenantal presence with you. Don't be careless. Don't be casual." The New American Standard says 50,070 men were killed for taking God so casually. Most scholars point out that there are some textual problems with this number, and various explanations have been brought up for it. The ancient Hebrews didn't use numbers, really. They used letters to represent numbers and be translated as numbers. So one way to translate this would be that there were 70 men who were killed, 5 for each 1,000 people in Beth Shemesh. That would mean 70 men were killed, representing a population of about 14,000 people, which is pretty reasonable and plausible as a way to reconstruct the textual problems of this passage. 70 men, I think, were killed here. Still a very serious judgment of God for looking into the ark. And the judgment, the execution, had the desired effect on the people. God is saying, "Don't take me too casually. Don't be too careless around me. Don't get too chummy with me. For I am a holy God. I am not safe for those who would be presumptuous, who would presume upon my grace and forgiveness. You cannot take me for granted, God says today too. My forgiveness is not automatic. Don't presume upon my grace. I am a holy God. I think that lesson is very, very important, vital for us today. If anything, we have a tendency to be too casual, too comfortable with God, too careless in our worship of God. We treat God like our best friend instead of a holy God, an awesome God. We presume upon His grace. Oh, well, I'll make this choice. I'll do these things even though I know they're wrong. Ah, God will forgive me. He'll kind of look the other way. I'll be okay. Don't count on it. Don't count on it. They weren't. Okay. 70 of them died. Fathers and husbands. That's pretty serious stuff. And God's the same God. We might have to learn the same lesson that the people of Beit Shemesh had to learn. And they cry out in fear, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God?" They got the message. This holy God. And they want no part of this kind of God. So they call the people of Kiriath-Jearim to come and take the ark away from them. God is too holy for them. He makes them feel uncomfortable. Get this out of here. By the way, it will stay at Kiriath-Jearim because nobody knows what to do with this ark anymore until David, King David, years and years later, will finally bring it to Jerusalem. And even King David will have an experience that he doesn't like in being too casual with God in that time. But get it out of here. He makes us feel uncomfortable. This holy God. Wow. I don't want this. You expect a $274 million building to shine. LA's new Walt Disney Concert Hall does. Frank Gehry's landmark creation of shimmering stainless steel is marvelous to behold, I'm told. I've never been there. People living in a condominium, however, facing the structure, say it is glorious, but they don't like it because the glory is overpowering when the noonday sun hits it and reflects off that stainless steel. Portions of the gleaming concert hall reflect so brilliantly into the windows of the condominium complex nearby that the temperature rises as much as 15 degrees, forcing residents to get off their patios, draw their blinds, turn on their air conditioners until the sunlight shifts. You couldn't even see, and then the furniture would get hot to touch on the patio. Said Jacqueline Legroni, age 42, lives on the fourth floor of the Promenade Residences. You would have to literally close the drapes and you'd still feel warmth in the house. So, Disney officials took that into account and they created these huge mesh blankets that they slide down over the shimmering steel. And everyone says that solves one problem, but they are really, really ugly. There's no solution. But how often are we tempted to tone down God's holy glare? Because it makes us uncomfortable in our lives, in our worship, in our experiences. Reduce the glare of the holiness of God. So I can live more comfortably. I can feel better about everything. How often do we try to avoid a holy God or even avoid talking about a holy God? and his glare into our lives. We don't want that kind of God. We want the chummy God, the buddy God. So we have to find a way to cover the glare of God's holiness in our lives, and that keeps us busy. Many years ago, I liked watching the television show Wide World of Sports. And for years on Wide World of Sports, the opening sequence of Wide World of Sports illustrated the agony of defeat by a skier coming down this ramp and falling off the side of the ramp and crashing down onto the structure below. And that was the agony of defeat. It's a great line. The skier looked good until he got partway down and then off he went. Why? Well, what viewers never were told was that he chose to do that. He chose to go off the side. And the reason he chose is that about halfway down, he realized that the ramp had become too icy, too fast, and he was going to outdistance the landing spot. And he was going to land on the flat, which could very likely be fatal. And so, in fear, he threw himself down and went off the side of the ramp. And they closed the ramp, of course, and started skiers from that point on from a spot farther down the ramp. Fear led to life. Fear led him to change his course. One fear, the fear of going off the side, was much less than the fear of outdistancing the landing spot and perhaps dying. Well, the fear of the Lord leads to life, for it draws us to who He really is in all of His holiness. He is a good God, but He is a fearsome God. The fear of God is a good thing for us. I really like the quote, and I'll end with this, by Oswald Chambers. I think I've used it before, who captured this truth. He said, "The remarkable thing about fearing God is that when you fear God, you fear nothing else. Whereas if you do not fear God, you fear everything else." That's a great lesson to learn, no matter what you are experiencing in the days ahead. Father, teach us to fear You. Teach us to honor You. Teach us to give You glory with our lives, knowing that as we fear You, we don't have to fear anything else. Illness, death, we don't have to fear anything else. Enemies, if we fear You, for You always lead us to life. In Jesus' name, amen.